of the bill is Representative Christ Tompkins and his staff, Claire Gross. Please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, representing rural Southeast Alaska and also sponsor of HB 246, the subject of today's hearing. House Bill 246 is inspired by a variety of things, previous legislative consideration, including passage of very similar legislation in the House in recent years, and also consideration of similar legislation in the other body in recent years. And it's most of all inspired and motivated by the passage of a citizens initiative that decriminalized marijuana in the state of Alaska. And what House Bill 246 does is remove from view for certain, but not all background checks, simple convictions for simple possession of marijuana. The motivation of the bill is that there are people who have simple possession of marijuana convictions on the record, and as the times have changed, as the laws have changed, as society has changed, that having these convictions on the record is an impediment in many instances from them to be a productive member of society as they seek employment and jobs and sort of establish their reputations. And I think also sort of more broadly, a motivation for this legislation is that marijuana is decriminalized, and it's increasingly decriminalized across the country, and that in order to sort of move beyond the prohibition era that we were in for so long with marijuana and recognizing the legality of the substance and that it is now regulated, that it makes sense not to sort of have these convictions sort of lingering on people's records in a way that seems sort of no longer with the current times. So those are the motivations for House Bill 246. And if it pleases the chair and the committee, can provide a brief sectional and then open up to...
Go ahead with this. I assume we have the room dark because there's some sort of a PowerPoint coming?
There is no PowerPoint. It's
why don't you go
a metaphor,
with
perhaps.
Sectional, and I suspect just my making noise magically the other lights will come on. Okay.
Oh, amazing. let there
Thank
be
you
light.
Very much.
So a quick overview of the bill, and then I would just note we have invited testimony, and then can open it up. But a quick overview of the bill. It's not to say that the policy and underlying issues are uncomplicated at all, but the statutory language of the bill is rather straightforward and simple. So Section 1 is a more succinct and pithy description of the legislative intent and what motivates the bill. It's a legislative intent section. Section 2 amends AS 1262-160B, subsection 8. Lays out that an additional excuse me, I'm just tethering this to what's in section 3 with 1262-160F. Well, this is the language that creates the exception that is described in Section 3, if I'm tethering these two together correctly in my mind. Section 3 as the new subsection, which adds criteria for criminal history record information that the agency cannot release. This relates to the types of convictions that this bill is about. Section 4 adds a new section relating to what the Alaska court system may or may not publish on CourtView on its publicly available internet website. What we all know is CourtView. And Section 5 is the effective date, January 1, 2023. And those are the five sections.
Okay. did you want to have some invited testimony first, or do you want to take questions from the committee first?
Maybe. Okay. We'll do questions.
Okay. So we'll turn to questions from committee members. Just going around the room, and as usual, that limits 1 minute per question. Anyone have questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Eastman?
Thank you, and through the chair. I see how Section 4 is written in such a way that it talks about a specific criminal case. And so you have the criteria describing the case in Section or Subsection 1, 2, and 3 there. And I noticed that in Section 2, because we're, you know, borrowing from a previous statute, the format and structure of the statute does not describe a specific case. And so I'm wondering, maybe a drafting decision, if it should describe a specific case. The way that it's currently written, I think, could possibly be misinterpreted. Because if you have someone in Section 3 that requests an agency not release all of their records, I'm looking where in the statute the agency would be able to say, well, okay, we're
Representative Eastman, I think you're at the one-minute mark, and I think the question is pretty clear. Why don't you have a specific case identified in Sections 3, 2, or 3?
I can try to answer this, or through the chair, Representative Eastman, Claire Gross, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. I think I might be able to answer this, and if not, we have our bill drafter online who could maybe correct me. But it was my understanding that because this is laying out this Section F, and then we go on to see Section F, basically, or that is described in Section 3, there we see the section F that was added. It is referring to a specific case because it refers to AS 1171060, and that's where it lays out exactly what type of possession charge this would have to be. Was that the question that you were asking? Like, specifically, what are we looking at for?
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So, at the bottom of page 2, line 30, it directs the agency that they may not release criminal history record information if the defendant, and then they go on to describe. And so if I was just to look at that language alone, and then I find that the defendant qualifies, say he has a murder conviction and a simple possession conviction, I'm just wondering how, as the agency, I know not to interpret that as, all right, this individual meets the criteria, so no criminal history record information of the defendant can be released.
I'm not sure I understand that, through the chair, Representative Eastman, totally understand that question still, but I do know that in that particular situation you just described, they wouldn't be eligible for record sealing with this bill because they have another charge or conviction in the same case. So in that particular type of section, we're only talking about cases where there is one minor marijuana possession and no other charges in that case. Does that change anything?
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, and I understand that you're absolutely correct as far as the case goes. I'm describing an individual who has two cases, a murder case and a possession case. And now, because he qualifies under this new statute, how do we instruct the agency that they can still go forward with releasing the murder information, which may have occurred previously or subsequently? Thank you.
So for clarity, you're asking about, say you've got a murder conviction from 1990 and a marijuana conviction from 2000. And the question is, it better be the marijuana conviction from 1990 and the murder conviction from 2000. But you're asking, does the marijuana conviction from 2000 require them not to release the murder conviction?
Exactly.
And Mr. Chair, I think I track where that's going. And is Ms. Radford online from Legislative Legal?
He's supposed to be.
Actually,
Yes. Ms. Radford, have you been following this exchange?
Yes, I have, Mr. Clement.
And can you answer the question raised by Representative Eastman?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Eastman. Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, this is Claire Radford with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, this would only allow someone who meets all four of those criteria laid out in Section 3 to be eligible for having their criminal history record information not disclosed. So if a person were to have two separate convictions in different cases, and one of those was a possession charge and another one was another crime, only the possession case would be eligible under this statute.
Before Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond joined us about a minute ago, and Representative Snyder joined us by teleconference at 1:12 p.m. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I might just sort of clarify or sharpen the question for Ms. Radford and Mr. Chair and Representative Eastman. If I'm going afield from the thrust of the question, please let me know. Ms. Radford, I think what we're focusing on is the language and lines 30 and 31 on page 2. And I think what Representative Eastman is surfacing is the language is criminal history record information, which is a sort of broad and encompassing term. And I think his point is that if you have someone who satisfies all four criteria on lines 1 through 7 on page 3, that then potentially all of their criminal history record information, as listed on line 30 on page 2, would no longer be released. And obviously the intent here is that it would be only the criminal history record information that relates to AS 1171060 would not be released, not all criminal history record information would be released. And so I think it's a stylistic or drafting question how the current language relates to what the intent is and what the committee is discussing right now.
Ms. Radford?
Thank you, through the chair. I believe that the language on lines 30 and 31 of page 2 do capture that intent, but if you would like to make it more clear, we could certainly include language that specifies it is for the specific criminal case.
Well, Ms. Radford, it strikes me, at least in reading through Section 3 and Section 4, that in the example I gave of a 1990 marijuana conviction and a 2000 murder conviction, that if someone asked for that person's criminal history because they didn't qualify under all four prongs in Section 3, all four subsections, that both the 1990 marijuana conviction and the 2000 murder would both be released as part of the criminal history because there's no exception for the marijuana. But in contrast, in Section 4, as to the individual case, using that case reference in subsection 3 of Section 4, even though the criminal history would reflect both convictions, the court system would no longer release the 1990 marijuana conviction on court view, but the court system would still release the 2000 murder conviction on court view. Is that how you read the bill, Ms. Radford?
Through the chair, I'm sorry, could you repeat that for me one more time? I think I'm getting a little confused.
Okay. The example we're working on is a 1990 marijuana conviction for half an ounce and a 2000 murder conviction. Under Section 3 of the bill, 1262-160, because of the way the four sections are written, the criminal history information would still reflect both the marijuana conviction and the murder conviction. But as to court view in Section 4 of the bill, AS 2235-040, the specific 1990 case involving marijuana would not be published on court view, but the murder conviction still would be published on court view.
Thank you. Through the chair, that would be correct.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Vance, looks looks like you weren't entirely sure you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to clarify it in my head so that I get it correct on the first out of the gate. It was noted, I believe, on the sponsor statement that there's about 700 affected people with these minor convictions. Do we know how many of those or what percentage of those have been unable to access employment or better employment because of these convictions?
Representative Vance, through the chair, and for the record, this is Representative Christ Tompkins. Various sort of secondhand anecdotes, but generally speaking, no, we're in the process of, given data availability and the ability to identify who those 700 people are, which may be the constraining factor, get sort of more vivid qualitative data on that question.
Second question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. This is concerning the fiscal note. And just my concern is adding additional personnel to be able to fulfill this. Obviously, we're still trying to find a long-term fiscal plan. This would, based on the fiscal note, would require additional personnel to be able to process each, go and research each individual paperwork. Do you foresee a way to reduce that fiscal note by having each individual person request information to not be made public on an individual basis versus let's add an entire person? Is that something that you have inquired about?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I believe the indefatigable Claire Gross in my office has quite a bit of knowledge on that very question.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Vance, Claire Gross, staff Representative Christ Tompkins. And I will have, I guess, Kelly Hall from DPS, if I am getting this totally wrong, maybe she can, I'll check with her after this and just make sure that this is, what I'm saying is correct. But when we were first looking at this bill, yet that was the case, that it was to reduce the burden on DPS and also the cost, we were doing a petition process for these type of background checks, whereas the court view section is automatic. This is a petition process. But we have recently learned that there might be some things changing with that, and that it's possible, it might take longer, or there are some other stipulations, but it might be possible to do this automatically without any extra cost. So it doesn't seem like that is necessarily the cause of the fiscal note or the cause of the cost. It's the person having to do it at all. It's going to cost that. And it's my understanding right now that the petition process would not decrease the cost from having it done automatically, which is something is new information and is leading us to maybe want to look at making it automatic as well. Does that answer the question or?
Follow up.
Representative Vance.
Just to clarify, so obviously, no matter what happens, there's going to be the need. The work on the internal side is going to happen. But are you saying that there's a possibility that the fiscal note could be reduced from what we see today?
No. Through the chair, Representative Vance, Clerk of Staff, Director Chris Tompkins. No is what we've been told now. The deal is that they actually doesn't change the cost at all. So, no, there's between petition and automatic, it doesn't reduce.
And for the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, I would just add that it's certainly our interest as the sponsoring office that any way that could lead to a smaller fiscal note is one that we would, with gusto and great entrepreneurial vigor, pursue should it be presented or identified.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you.
And Representative Eastman, I see you, but you've had some questions that Representative Drummond hasn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies for stepping in late. On the fiscal note, is that one position in FY23 and an additional position in FY24? And just in those years, in other words, in the out years, that position goes away.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, Claire Gross, staff Representative Chris Tompkins. I would defer to Kelly Howell on this, or another representative from DPS. But maybe
Kelly Howell is about as well positioned to answer that question as anyone we could ask for. Ms. Howell, welcome. Been some years since you joined us in the Judiciary Chamber.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm a Special Assistant to the Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety and also the Legislative Liaison for the Department. I do want to mention that we have Lisa Purinton online. She is the subject matter expert on this topic. But to answer your question, Representative Drummond, through the chair, the fiscal note is based on, there's two parts to it. One is a programming cost to our criminal history repository. APSIN is what folks frequently know it by. Programming would be required to shield these records from disclosure, so that would need to be accomplished. The position was intended for researching the criminal history records, and that would be given that the offense is currently no longer illegal, there would be a set number of records that person could go through, and therefore it would be a temporary position, we estimated, you know, a period of 2 years. So it is one position over 2 years.
And I'd note just for clarity, at least as I'm glancing through the fiscal note, it looks like when you prepared the fiscal note, it was the understanding that these would be done upon request rather than automatically.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I believe the fiscal note also clarifies that should there be adequate downtime where the individual could proactively research some records in between requests, again, not knowing how many individuals would actually petition to have this information prohibited from being released, that person could also do that as a proactive measure.
And Representative Drummond, go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Howell. So the programming appears to be the difference between year one and year two for about $63,000 for the programming that would be spent in FY23 or appropriated in FY23, and the underlying position, the staffing position, is the 121.2 in each of those 2 years.
Representative Drummond, through the chair, I believe the programming costs are $56,000. I don't have fiscal note right in front of me. I left my file in my chair. So the second year costs, I think there's a reduction in some of the commodities or supplies that would be associated with that position. But yes, primarily the second year costs are all related to personal services and support costs for that position.
And one further.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Ms. Howell, you said you'll be reprogramming Aspen to shield records from exposure, but that doesn't mean the records go away. The records can be obtained. When I had this bill several years ago, the records are still obtainable, but you need to go to the courthouse to see them rather than obtain them online. So this is shielding them from court view. And I don't know, I can't tell yet from the DPS system or not.
So Representative Drummond, through the chair, I would like to defer to Lisa Purinton. I can tell you that the information that would be prohibited from disclosure would be in relation to background checks that individuals request, and the information would still be in apps, and it would still be part of that individual's criminal history. It just would not be releasable as part of a background check in certain cases.
Any other questions before we let Ms. Howell go? Any other questions for Ms. Howell? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. How does the department anticipate that individuals become aware of this option to request that their records be sealed?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I can imagine that we would have information on our website similar to what we have now regarding correction of criminal justice information or information about our background checks, that if an individual should want to have this information prohibited from disclosure, they could request that via, I'm assuming, a form. Again, Lisa Purinton would have a better idea of how the mechanics of that would work.
Okay. Okay, follow up.
Representative Eastman.
And if I am one of these individuals and I'm eligible to have this sealed and I go to request a copy of my criminal record history, is there an anticipation that at the time that I go and make that request, there'll be something on the form or someone, you know, at the desk will let me know, hey, this is an option that, that you can avail yourself of?
So just to note, Representative Eastman, the bill as drafted doesn't have a, this is not, the bill as drafted is an automatic removal. There's no request involved. The failure to automatically remove might cause somebody to say, I'm supposed to be off. But the way it's drafted, it's an automatic removal.
Through the chair, I'm wondering, why then do we include in the latter section the requested by the individual? Is that kind of superfluous? Can we get rid of that? Or does that have some kind of legal consequence?
Sounds like a question for the bill sponsor. But I was looking in different places, including the sponsor statement. They do reference automatic removal.
And if I could interject quickly, I think there might be a misunderstanding through the chair, Senator Gross, staff representative Price Tompkins. The simple thing that I've been explaining that this bill does is it does two things, and it's actually two separate things, and that is the removal from records on court view by the court system, and that's like, we'll call that the first half, even though it's not in that order. And the second half is with DPS, and that is these background checks that employers can do, or really anyone, it's called an any person's report can go in, but that is what the employers usually use to look into people's backgrounds. And that specific type of background check is what will be, and only those convictions will be shielded from those types of background checks. So they're actually two totally different things with the different departments. So I just want to make sure. And the court view is automatic. As it's written now, the absent background checks is a petition process. And that's what we were talking about after finding out that DPS might be going through these records altogether anyway, whether people are petitioning or not. That was what kind of led to the idea that maybe we want to go ahead and make this automatic because there's not an extra cost, which was the original reason for not making it automatic.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's what inspires my question. When you go to the desk and you make that request for your criminal record histories, is there going to be a way that I get notified on a form or the person handling my request that this is an option that I can take advantage of?
Representative Eastman through the chair. This is Kelly Howell with Public Safety again. That may be getting a little into the weeds of how this would be implemented. I am imagining that we would perhaps have that on the form, that if their record contained that history or that particular conviction, that they could request to have that released or prohibited from being released. But again, that's part of the implementation of it and how we would inform individuals who may have this particular conviction in their criminal history, besides posting it on the website and potentially including it on the form when they request the criminal history background check. Those are just assumptions that I'm making on how that would be how we would notify the defendant of that information.
Can I follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And dealing with the fiscal note specifically, would that type of kind of more proactive activity on the part of the department, would that trigger a larger fiscal note, or do you think that would be able to be captured in the current fiscal note?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, the fiscal note as it's currently drafted is based on how the bill is currently written, which is upon request. So we anticipate that that it would take, not knowing how many individuals would actually come forth and request that the information be prohibited from disclosure. We want to designate a person specifically for that effort. In the event that there aren't as many as we're assuming may come forward, that position would be proactive. Currently, the bill has an effective date of January 1st, 2023. So certainly a 6-month time period or give or take a couple of months is not sufficient for us to go through the number of records that would be required to be reviewed to determine whether they met the criteria in the bill. So so the fiscal note would potentially change if the bill remains written as it currently is.
Thank you.
Ms. Gross, you had a follow-up comment?
Yeah, I think there's one more thing here that's important to note for the chair, Thurgos, staff to represent Price Tompkins. We had talked about this, the number of 700 as being the people affected, and that was our estimates from the courts, and that's kind of a data analysis they did a while ago. If you see in the analysis for this fiscal note, they're actually using the number of like 8,500 people as being affected, which I think we got down to something like 8,000 with no repeats, because that's counting all the people who may have more than one of these commit. Well, that's counting the cases, not the people. So it went down to about 8,000. So I just wanted everybody to notice that it's, we're not talking about the 700 with that loss. It's actually much more.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Forgive me if I'm asking a question that's been addressed. There was a little bit of connectivity issues. This follows on the fiscal note conversation, I think. Thank you for that clarification on 8,000 being part of the calculus as opposed to 700. I think that's a very important distinction in interpreting the fiscal note. I'm also curious, in the creation of that fiscal note, and this may be for the bill sponsor or for, forgive me, I'm losing track of individuals we're speaking with, who created the fiscal note, did you have the opportunity to look at other states that might have implemented a similar measure or taken a similar step and to see what was required in their instance? Are there examples elsewhere we can learn from?
I think that's a question for Ms. Gross.
through the chair, Representative Snyder, Claire Gross, staff to Representative Price-Tompkins, was the question about if we'd looked into with the cost, how other states have been able to do this and keep their costs low or in another way, or did you mean in general if we looked at it?
Yes, through the chair, I think either. I'm curious if you were to say to look at another state, if another state had implemented this, I guess that's my first foundational question. Are there some comparable states we can look at? And if the answer is yes, if you were to look at how many individuals this applies to in that state and, you know, make a relative calculation based on our numbers, do the fiscal notes compare? Are they consistent? Or what other factors should have been considered in calculating the fiscal notes?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Snyder, Claire Gross, staff representative Crichton-Tompkins, we absolutely did look at, looked exhaustively at all the other states, and most of them have some sort of record ceiling or other laws that go along with this. And we definitely looked at other states that have decriminalized marijuana, and a very large percentage of them, I would say, had included something along with their ballot initiative or when they changed the law that immediately did this with record ceiling and most states actually go much farther than we do. They have things like reducing felonies and, you know, totally dropping much more serious marijuana charges, and they're doing it kind of in all different parts of their criminal record system. So this is, I mean, I don't want to say this definitively, but I would say that we have one of the weakest sort of ideas for what we're doing here. It does the least out of what is the norm, I think, for other states, but we can certainly, like, I can compile something with that information, some relevant and, or some states that have closer situations to ours, so we could look at that if that would be something that is helpful. And maybe I could work with you in your office to see specifically what kind of information I could include in that. That would be helpful. But we do have some on other states for sure.
Thank you. That's it, Mr. Turner.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is question is for Ms. Howell. I'm unfamiliar with what these convictions would look like on a background check. You know, I'm an employer who is new to this, and I pull up a background check. What does this specific conviction look like? Is it more general, or does it specifically say, hey, this is having to do with marijuana? I'm just trying to get a feel of how egregious this looks in the process and the need to expedite this.
Representative Vance, through the chair, this is Kelly Howell with Public Safety again. If it's all right with you, Representative, I would like to defer that question to Lisa Purinton. She would be able to explain exactly how it's displayed on a criminal history background check.
So before we completely let you off the hook, then we'll get Ms. Pierton on. I had one question, Ms. Howell. Do you know if the administration has taken a position on this legislation at this point?
I do not, Mr. Okay. Chair.
All right. Ms. Pierton, did you hear the question from Representative Vance?
Good afternoon. This is Lisa Pierton, Bureau Chief for the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau with the Department of Public Safety. Through the chair, you know, Representative Vance's question regarding how this would display on a criminal background check. The way the information is displayed out of our system, it actually lists the statute, it lists the severity level of the statute, and then it has a somewhat generic offense description, but it would currently be displayed as misconduct involving a controlled substance in the sixth degree, possession of less than 1 ounce of a scheduled drug. So it doesn't actually reference marijuana specifically. It's using the drug schedule that's established on there.
Representative Vance.
What other drugs could be, besides marijuana, could be fall under this schedule?
This schedule is specific to marijuana. Through the chair, I'm sorry, Representative Vance. This would be specific, the schedule drug classification is specific to marijuana.
Okay, thank you.
One follow-up question on Representative Vance, and I'll get to Representative Eastman. Ms. Pierton, in an absent printout that one might see in a criminal case, it would still show the marijuana conviction under any circumstances, but under a background check that was sent to DPS, if this legislation passed, the potential employer, for example, would not see the marijuana conviction.
To the chair, Representative Klayman, you're absolutely correct. If this bill passes, the information as outlined in this bill would not be displayed on a criminal history background check as outlined in this bill.
Right. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just curious, are there any other offenses that currently would not be displayed on a background check for whatever reason? I'm assuming that we're talking about sort of a full background check, not just like a last 5 years version. But do we have any other bills that have passed the legislature kind of like this in the past, which have set aside one or more offenses to be sealed and not available on that history background check?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, Lisa Pierson, for the record, best of my knowledge, I don't believe there has been any recent legislation that selectively limits what information is displayed on a criminal background check outside of what is listed in our sealing laws.
Thank you.
Ms. Purinton, what about on the, this is a background check that gets submitted by the example being an employer to the Department of Public Safety. What about somebody who was convicted and or was charged, found guilty, but was given a suspended imposition of sentence and they completed the suspended imposition of sentence and had the finding discharged? Will you still show the SIS, as they're commonly called, on your background check?
Chair Representative Klayman, Chair Klayman, the information as outlined in this bill, we would look at the complete set-aside to be withheld from being displayed in the background check as outlined in this bill.
Right, but I've actually gone off on a slightly different tangent. I'm not talking about the marijuana conviction. Let's say I have a fishing license conviction. I charged and I plead guilty to a fishing license charge and the judge suspends imposition of sentence and a year later I complete the suspended imposition of sentence. And somebody then later requests my background check. Will that fishing license or that fishing criminal violation show up on my background check or will the SIS, the suspended imposition of sentence completion, have that be removed from the background check?
to the chair, that information would be displayed on a criminal background check.
Okay. I got a question from Representative Eastman. Go ahead, Representative.
Yeah, follow up from that through the chair. Just curious, so would that reflect the same way that someone receiving a commuted sentence or I guess more appropriately a pardon? So if someone receives a pardon, is that going to be reflected similarly as we anticipate in this bill, should someone meet those criteria?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I am not 100% positive. I would have to do some research to determine. We don't see very many pardons, so I'm afraid I don't know right off the top of my head if that would display on a criminal history check.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions from Ms. Purinton? All right. Any other questions? Representative Christ-Hopkins, I know you've got the court system here. Did you want some invited testimony from the court system? I think we probably got whatever Ms. Howell would provide by way of invited testimony. Did we want the court system to make any presentation, or is she just here for questions? She has this look in her eyes that suggests she's here for questions.
For the record, Jonathan Christ-Hopkins, coordinated plan to proactively present information, but if the court system would like to present anything, we fully welcome it. If any members have questions, of course, Ms. Mead is always extremely good at fielding them.
Ms. Mead, did you want to comment, or you just want to take questions? It looks like you're choosing make a short presentation, short statement or whatever. Go ahead, Ms. Mead. Welcome back, Judiciary. It's also been quite a while since we've seen you in this room.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the court system, and I don't have anything specifically prepared. But I do want to point out that there might be a little bit of confusion in people's minds between Department of Public Safety and the court with respect to this bill. The court system is only concerned with Section 4 of this bill. This tells us what we can put on court view. Court view has nothing to do with criminal background checks. So Sections 2 and 3, which you spoke to Ms. Howell about, are all about what the Department of Public Safety can release. It doesn't touch court view. It doesn't touch the court system whatsoever. And all Section 4 does is tell us to remove these cases from court view. And to be clear, those cases would still be available at a courthouse. And in fact, we have a separate kiosk in every courthouse where you can look up what we call unpublished cases, cases that were once posted but cannot be posted by law. And you can learn about them. This just makes the availability of them much more limited for members of the public at home. And we have a different number of cases that we've identified as fitting the criteria than the Department of Public Safety. We're working together to try to see where those discrepancies occur.
Representative Kirka. Beginning to think you'd fallen asleep at the wheel for a little bit.
Well, it felt like it. But this brings up a question I think hasn't been asked yet. So it sounds like there's two separate databases. Are they linked between the Department of Public Safety and the court system?
Through the chair to Representative Kirka, no.
Thank you. And through the chair, my other question is, I guess this would be the basis of the thinking that we would separate what you can go into a courtroom and access in person in terms of information. It's still publicly available, but it requires a lot of work to get to it versus what we'd publish online. Because it seems to me this is the 21st century, and if we deem something to be acceptable for public consumption in terms of the public has a right to see it, why would we remove that from the internet?
Through the chair. Mr. Sherman, must I wear the mask to speak?
Please do.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Kirka, it's mostly because the bill would be telling us to have two different systems. At one point, there could be, the legislature could say to make these cases confidential. If the legislature says that and you have for other case types, for example, child in need of aid case files or juvenile delinquency, then they are completely inaccessible, whether at the courthouse or on the internet. Juvenile delinquency cases aren't on court view, and you can't get the file. That is sometimes frowned upon because the media or members of the public think, well, I still want to know what happened. So this sort of compromise saying it won't be on court view, but you can access it at the courthouse, takes away most of the people who are looking at these records for just general purposes. If you have a need, you can come down and you can find out because it isn't, quote, confidential. But if you're just looking at court view in your home to decide to look up a neighbor, or if you're taking that as a means to a free means to do a background check and it's not official, you're not going to get access to that from home. If you care a lot, you can come down to the courthouse and get more complete information.
Olive?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I guess I have two questions.
Ask them one at a time.
Yeah. It just seems kind of double-minded to me. So has the legislature ever decided that, other than the cases you mentioned, where we decided this is, you know, confidential because the individual's a minor, for example, other than those cases where there's no availability to pull those, create them open without a court case or a new case calling them to be open, are there any situations you're aware of where the legislature has said we want these to be not available on the internet, but we kind of, the situation you're describing where we want them to be available but not available on the internet?
Through the chair to Representative Kirka, yes. And there are, in addition, court rules that make certain case types not available on the internet and yet not confidential and therefore available at a courthouse. The main category from the legislature was about 2015 when a statute said that the court must remove from court view retroactively any criminal case that ended with a complete acquittal or dismissal or a combination of acquittal or dismissal. So in other words, if at the end of the case there were no convictions, we then had to remove that case from court view. There were many, many, many thousands of cases that we removed retroactively in response to that. And that would be one category of what we call unpublished cases. There are also cases by court rule. It's Administrative Rule 40A, and it has 13 subsections. Unpublish, that is removed from the internet, cases, for example, where a domestic violence protective order was filed, and immediately at the ex parte initial hearing, the judicial officer found no probable cause, did not set on additional hearings, dismissed the case. And the thinking there, like the thinking here, is that people shouldn't suffer consequences from casual users of court view for something that really, as a policy matter, is something that the person sort of didn't do anything wrong and should thereafter not be suffer consequences from having it posted online. Those are just examples. There are many other categories.
I'll be done for now.
Thank you. I have your name on my list, Representative Vance, but I think that I forgot to cross you off as having yes to your questions. But did you have another question?
Yes.
And I was right. Good. Please proceed.
Thank you. So for clarification, we've described, you know, that this process would prevent the public from having that general access to these convictions. But on the flip side, who still has full access to be able to look at these records?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, this solely removes them from court view. You, a member of the media, a member of law enforcement, anybody can walk into a courthouse anonymously, use the kiosk and put in my name and get my unpublished cases. This would be one of those. So it isn't available at home, but it's a separate database that we make available. And they can then get the case number and walk up to the counter if he or she wishes and get the full case file in paper. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I do have a follow-up.
Representative Vance.
Apologize.
No apologies for follow-ups.
I don't remember your name.
Ms. Gross.
Ms. Gross, yes. And I should have asked this, with Ms. Howell, but I think you may be able to answer this, is on the DPS side, who still has access to this information in, besides the general public for background checks, who is going to be able to still access these records?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Vance, we have a number of exceptions to this. The only type of background checks that are, like we're saying, that are going to be affected by this bill are the any person's report types. And so those are just this general, anybody can go in there and get them. There are still interested person's reports, for instance, which is a background check. And these are for people who work with children and vulnerable adults, which was something that was kind of identified along the way, that maybe there's certain types of employment that we don't want to have their records sealed, like people working in law enforcement and working with adults, vulnerable adults and children and whatnot. So that was already in statute, and we just haven't touched it. So the interested persons report, that's the children and vulnerable adults. There's something officially called a full criminal history report, background check, and I was told that mostly relates to overseas travel and immigration type requests. Haven't gotten too deep into that, but we've been working from the idea that those should still be exempt as well, should not be sealed with this bill as well. And under Alaska Statute 1262-400, there is a long list of all types of potential employee or types of jobs for which you require state licensure. And all of those jobs will not be able to petition for or receive automatically record sealing. And those include, a couple of things from people who work with children as well. And there's a lot of them that I think a lot of people would agree we do want kept from background check sealing. And then there's some that might not seem quite as related, but we're still looking into that a little bit further. But for now, and then there's also police officers and any actors with the criminal justice system, basically. And that's actually covered by more than one statute that they are going to have this background check no matter what. And then anybody having to do, any actors from the criminal justice system, any prosecutors, any judges, anybody will have complete and total access on both sides of this to, well, I guess not the court view, but that's not where they get their information anyway, mostly, I think. So they would be able to get any kind of background check they want.
Great. That's very helpful. Thank you.
I'm not sure this question is whether it's for Ms. Gross or Representative Price-Tompkins, but how do you distinguish this bill from what I often heard described as an expungement law? This is not a Ms. Mead question. This is either Representative Price-Tompkins or Ms. Gross.
Really? Okay. Through the chair to the chair?
Not through the chair. It's
okay,
just
through the chair.
Yeah, you just say Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, yes. Expungement isn't really what we're doing here, so we don't want to use that word. Expungement has much more of a meaning of it's completely gone. That has burned the records, basically. It never existed. It's as though it never happened. And that is not what we're doing here. And we don't want all the limitations that would come with that as well from having to exempt all these other people that we do want to have access to background records and whatnot. This is just kind of the proposal that has been brought up several times and in different bills. And so I think we're keeping the same level of how far we want to go with this one until we can get some consensus on it.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee or Representative Eastman.
A question for the bill sponsor. Through the chair. So in Section 1, which I guess we haven't really addressed yet, I know it's uncodified law. Even so, I'm not used to seeing words like today, which appears on line 8 in law, either codified or uncodified. And I'm wondering, what do we mean by today's laws? Because you know, if that goes into uncodified law in the future, it'll still say today. Are we trying to reference a specific date and time? And if we're trying to do that, I think maybe referencing a specific date might be especially clear. Or I could see some confusion with, you know, going to today a couple years from now, and somebody reads today and thinks that it's talking about that day as opposed to this day.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I appreciate the spirit and the direction of the question. I think you're right that we may want to change to a more language that does not float with the context and the contemporaneous moment in which the word is read, but rather cite something specific. I mean, what this is getting at is basically the post-decriminalization citizens initiative. Of course, I think we all can infer that, but we should make sure the legislative intent is a bit more precise and we can tighten that up.
I will note there's a rumor that I've heard in my office that you may be working on a committee substitute that you may ask us to present in the near future.
To the chair, potentially. As we take in more information, so we're assessing the most prudent next step. So,
all right.
TBD, I guess.
Okay. Better TBD than TMI.
Yes.
Does any other questions from the committee? Hearing nothing further, we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 246. If you are on the phone, well, actually, I'll first ask, is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 246? We do have somebody here from public. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and we generally, I think we give you, I can't remember whether it's 2 minutes or 3 minutes, but I'll probably give you 3 minutes because I can't see, it doesn't say in my notes what the timeline is. Please proceed, identify yourself.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lacey Wilcox. I'm the president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association, recognizing that that's not, that, you know, it's an industry trade group, it's not really affected. I did want to testify in support of the concept that we're seeing today. Obviously, as an advocate for legalization, we've long talked about things like expungement, sealing of records, and removing these barriers for housing, education, and other, you know, important citizen things that we need to be contributing members of society. So I am obviously in support of any gesture that moves the ball down the field. So I would consider this an incremental change. It is very thin, as was said, I think was the word. It's pretty weak when you're thinking about what other states are doing. As far as I have researched, over 20 states have some mechanism for an expungement, whether it's automatic in their ballot measure, if they did a ballot measure, or if it was something that a legislature did, it would be automatic in that. And it goes much further. So this is pretty diluted, but it's incremental progress. And that is what cannabis advocates have learned to accept. We are not going to get all the way where we want to go. It took a lot of years to get to where we got. And we'll take these incremental steps. So I appreciate the sponsor and prior sponsors of similar legislation for the work they've done to get this here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 246? I'm also looking. I don't see anyone that has called in to provide public testimony on House Bill 246. Is there, and we don't see anybody, no, there's nobody that's called in to provide public testimony. Last call for public testimony, hearing and seeing none. We're going to close public testimony on House Bill 246. And we will hold this bill. Actually, before I say, I would just note this. The topic of expungement has been a sort of a live topic on the marijuana stuff, and it's been interesting to see that in the discussions, and this came up several times in my service on the Criminal Justice Commission, we could never get any agreement to recommend expungement. The general sense that if something is in your court records that you should remove court records from public view was something that was a lot of opposition. People didn't like that notion. There's this real, as I think Ms. Mead was highlighting, there is a real distinction between what you can find on court view and what you can find if you go to the courthouse, which is consistent with the notion that they're public records and they're still available, but also recognition that sometimes what happens with court view is people kind of go further with court view than it may be appropriate, which I think is reflected in both our decision as a legislature, but also the court system's decision to have some restrictions on what's available in court view. And I think the fact this is not an expungement law is a reflection of the ongoing debate that's going on in our state about how do you deal with what are in fact public records, but you're also left with a changing law landscape in which you now have, I guess, 8,000 some odd convictions for marijuana that today, under current law, Representative Eastman, is legal conduct, and how do you deal with that? Not an easy question. So we'll hold House Bill 246 for further review. We'll adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, January 21st at 1 p.m. Last year, we heard House Bill 183, Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission, sponsored by my office. We took questions from the committee, opened and closed public testimony, and held the bill for further review. The reviser is going to be suggesting a relatively minor committee substitute, which will circulate to the committee as soon as we receive it. But if you have any amendments for House Bill 183, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 o'clock on Thursday, January 20th, that's tomorrow. It's my intention to take amendments to House Bill 183 during our meeting on Friday and then pass the bill out of committee following final questions and discussion. So please make your plans to attend Friday's meeting in person so you can sign the necessary paperwork. And with that, Representative Kirkland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we wanted to do amendments, I guess how do we know if we haven't seen the planned committee substitute?
What I would suggest is go ahead and request the amendment, because we can always take it as a conceptual amendment, and to the extent that the changes that the committee substitute relates to is that under established precedent and practice and with concurrence from the Attorney General's office, that when we see commissions and entities sunset, the actual reality with the sunset date is when there's a sunset, there's a year windup. And there have been a number of times when after something sunsetted on a particular date that they're in the windup year because they can't really end immediately. And that's, there's a number of instances in legislative history with other boards and commissions where they had a sunset year. So the Criminal Justice Commission under the statute that created it by statute ended on the 30th of June, 2021. So they're in the wind-up year. So the legislation that was introduced last year was written with the notion that the legislature would act during last session. And so the change in the CS will actually be making it so that it recognizes that the Criminal Justice Commission is in the wind-up year right now. So the likelihood of any amendments you would be making would have to do with the substance of the bill rather than the timing of the bill. So I would say, to the extent the lines might change where the amendment would go, I don't think we'll be under any confusion about what amendment you're trying to make.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I appreciate the clarification on the windup here. I'm just wondering, what's the legal effect of passing that amendment, or not passing the amendment? What's the consequence?
Not passing the amendment or the CS?
Yes.
You mean if we didn't pass the bill?
Well, I understand we have the bill, and we talked about that. You just had addressed the CS briefly, and I'm wondering, what's the legal consequence of not clarifying that there's this wind-up year for that commission?
Oh, you mean, in other words, if we came in on Friday and didn't adopt the CS?
Yes, yes. What's the value? I'm not clear.
The reviser of statutes came to my office and said, well, you have a technical problem with this bill and you have to fix it. So I believe this is, my understanding is a technical issue, and it's a technical issue that is technically, it is substantive in the world of our timing, but it is not substantive in terms of the subject matter and the content of the bill.
Got it. Thank you very much.
And if you want to, if we can find, I know I read some AG's opinions and other instances about other boards and commissions where they were in the sunset year, and there was discussion with the Attorney General's office. Did they concur that the Criminal Justice Commission is in the wind-up year where we are today? And everybody that looked at it all said, yeah, they're in the wind-up year.
Okay.
Okay. Other questions? All right. We will, that will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:08 p.m.